gentle, angry people, and we are singing, singing for our lives.
Gentle, angry students raising their voices against fossil fuel. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
We are, in effect, trying to turn the patient's own tumor into a vaccine.
The real question is, should somebody somewhere on this planet be trying to solve this problem?
Nothing matters as much as where you do your residency.
This is the first generation. They're putting a Model T in my chest.
The only natural disaster that we can actually do something about.
We were dead wrong.
If stress puts
Any
you
kind
at risk
of
for
So what this produces is a protein that tells the cells to divide. And what they'll do is they'll divide.
That's what the leak said.
Okay, we're all done. You did great.
On today's show, how a gigantic dino darling made a comeback, why Thomas Jefferson was obsessed with finding a live mastodon, and when a really risky operation may be your best bet. But first up, college students around the country are pushing for their schools to divest from fossil fuels. That means selling off investments in coal, oil, and gas companies from endowments, the savings accounts of colleges that earn interest and help fund everything from financial aid to keeping the lights on. Students' efforts succeeded at Stanford, which got rid of its portfolio of coal in 2013. This whole movement, though, began at Swarthmore College about 4 years ago, and students at this school are still struggling to make their voices heard. Carolyn Beeler reports.
So together they go like this. Just listen.
We will build power.
Dozens of students are crowded into a hallway outside of the finance offices at Swarthmore College, learning a new protest song.
So let's split, like, right here.
It's the middle of March and the first day of an extended sit-in at the elite liberal arts college with a nearly $2 billion endowment. Sophomore Stephen O'Hanlon and senior Sarah Blasevich helped organize the sit-in.
We're asking them to fully divest our endowment, so sell off all of our holdings in the top 200 fossil fuel companies, so coal, oil, and gas companies.
Divestment is a way for our school as an institution with a lot of social standing and a lot of clout to stigmatize the fossil fuel industry.
Climate change activist Bill McKibben, who visited Swarthmore on day 8 of the sit-in, explained divestment isn't meant to stop the flow of cash to these well-capitalized energy companies.
No one's under the illusion that if Swarthmore or any other college sells its shares in Exxon, that will immediately bankrupt Exxon. What it will do is begin the process, further the process of politically bankrupting them.
By that, he means creating a world where campaign contributions from fossil fuel companies will carry the same stigma as cash from big tobacco.
Making it much harder for them to dominate our political life the way they have.
Swarthmore's divestment movement launched in 2011 when Sarah Blasevich says it was the only one of its kind.
When our campaign started, it was sort of scrappy. It didn't have a ton of support. We didn't have a network the way that the divestment movement has a network now.
In 2012, Bill McKibben wrote a widely read Rolling Stone article on divestment that launched the movement into the national spotlight.
We went from being a handful of campaigns across the country to literally hundreds.
Last week, Syracuse University became the school with the largest endowment to announce it would divest. That follows roughly two dozen mostly small U.S. schools to have done so. But most other schools have said no to divestment, including Swarthmore in 2013.
Primarily because we thought divestment would be too costly.
That's Swarthmore Board of Managers Chair Gil Kemp, who says the school's nearly $2 billion endowment could lose $11 to $15 million a year in returns.
Those many millions of dollars would, among other things, impact severely our ability to provide needs-blind admission, which is a core value of Swarthmore and absolutely critical to our mission.
The board argued investing in campus energy efficiency would be a better way to fight climate change.
We don't believe that divestment would be an effective way of reducing, ultimately, the amount of carbon that the world is dangerously releasing.
Endowments at the 500 richest U.S. colleges and universities are worth nearly $500 billion. It's not known how much of this money, or even just Swarthmore's endowment, is invested in fossil fuel companies. But for some perspective, a random selection of three schools that recently have disclosed this information, NYU, Bowdoin, and Middlebury, have between 1.4 and 5% of their endowments invested in fossil fuels. Divestment of these funds is a controversial tactic, even among those working toward policy solutions to fight climate change. That's including Andrew Holland at the D.C.-based think tank American Security Project.
There are effective ways to fight climate change, and there are ineffective ways to fight climate change. And I think that the divestment movement fundamentally is looking in the wrong direction.
The moral argument of the demonstrators doesn't hold water with Holland.
Listen, I mean, stigma doesn't work for the fossil fuel companies. Stigma hasn't stopped these companies from becoming some of the largest in the world. And frankly, it's the fact that they produce a product that all of us need for the current economy.
Swarthmore senior Sarah Blazevich has heard all of these criticisms. She's been a climate organizer since her first month of freshman year. Sometimes trying to tackle a problem as gigantic as climate change can be daunting.
Last spring, I was sort of coming out of a particularly rough patch in our campaign and feeling really demoralized and not actually sure whether it was worth it, putting in all the hours into keeping it going.
Her low point came during finals week. Blazevich was taking a study break when she noticed a video one of her cousins had posted on Facebook.
It was being shot from a helicopter with a cell phone. And at first, all I could see was this brown sea.
As the helicopter dropped lower, she noticed there were rooftops that seemed to be floating in this brown sea.
And there were people standing on them, and that this was a village that was entirely underwater.
The villagers reminded Blazevich of family members who lived in the Balkans, in a tiny village on the banks of a river. People especially at risk to increasingly extreme weather events that are expected with climate change.
I think for me that was a really pivotal moment where I was forced to make a choice about whether or not I would close my computer screen and walk away and forget that this was happening and kind of let the campaign peter off, or whether I would allow that to galvanize me.
Galvanize her it did. Blazevich helped organize Swarthmore's sit-in to demand the school's board of managers come back to the negotiating table on the topic of divestment.
Yeah, we have people rotating in and out during the day and at night.
Into the sit-in's second week, the hallway where the students were camping out was cluttered with sleeping bags, pillows, an old pizza box, and a giant plastic bin full of food.
We are not in need of snacks at all.
That's freshman Annie Zhao, who sat on a sleeping pad doing homework late that night.
We've had such an outpouring of support. At one point, we had 15 to 20 pizzas backlogged in various refrigerators in the building.
I checked in with Stephen O'Hanlon, who was among the more than 100 people who had taken shifts sitting and sleeping in the hallway by that time.
Okay, so day 12, right?
Yeah.
How's it going?
It's going well. I think I've lost count at this point. I think I've slept here 8 nights. It's not too bad sleeping here. It's just that we don't have control over the lights, so there's like every third light in the hallway is on.
And how are you feeling then during the day? Are you feeling tired both from the activity of organizing all this and not getting that much sleep, or do you feel like it's invigorating you?
I think it's both. There's fatigue. I feel tired sometimes, but also I feel really, really excited about what we're doing, and I feel like it's something that's really important.
Plenty of social movements begun by earnest students have ended without the targeted industries batting an eye. But today's anti-fossil fuel activists claim kinship to the anti-apartheid divestment movement of the 1980s, which also started on college campuses amid choruses of criticism. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. On to something totally different now. The PBS miniseries, Twice Born, takes viewers inside of an intense surgery unit at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Doctors there operate on babies still inside their mother's wombs. We're joined now by some of the main characters featured in this dramatic documentary. Dr. Scott Adzik is Surgeon-in-Chief at the Center for Fetal Diagnosis and Treatment and a pioneer and leader in this field. We're also joined by Bobby and Shelley Ross. They used the center services after finding out their unborn daughter had a life-threatening birth defect. Thank you all for being here.
It's nice to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Shelley and Bobby, how did you find out that there was an issue when you were pregnant with your daughter?
We went in for her 18-week ultrasound to mostly we thought we were going to find out if it was a boy or a girl, and we're very excited. So it was pretty devastating to find out that she had spina bifida myelomeningocele. We were not expecting that at all. So we were told at that appointment that she had a very large defect and that there's a lot of complications that would likely come from that.
What did you hear about her outcomes, about her prognosis, Bobby?
So when we initially got the diagnosis on October 28th, 2013, they could only guess from what they saw the exact level without an MRI, and we were told that it was L1 down, which would meant probably paralysis weakness from the waist down, no control of bowel or bladder, 80%, more than likely needing shunt and intervention into the brain, more than likely needing some sort of help for her feet because they would have been clubbed feet. At that time as well, they also said that there was a chance that she had Down syndrome because there was some marker for that. And it was one of those situations where as she talked, it just kept getting worse and worse and worse.
And when did you find out about the potential of fetal surgery?
So the doctor who told us, who read that high-level ultrasound and explained to us what she saw, told us that our baby had spina bifida and we could pursue getting surgery after she was born, which is kind of historically what had been done. Or she said there was this newer surgery being done in utero and that she would help us pursue that if that was something we were interested in. So she told us, and I had never heard about it, but we said we'd like to hear more about that.
I want to play a clip from the documentary Twice Born, and this is where the two of you are in a consultation with the medical director at the program at CHOP. So let's take a listen to that.
I'm glad you guys had a good trip in. Just was down talking to the neuroradiologist and to Dr. Adzik. Mm-hmm. So it looks like things have progressed to the point where there is officially hindbrain herniation evident on the MRI. And so if this is the route you still want to take, having the fetal surgery is on the table.
Okay.
So. I think that's probably the route we'd want to take.
Yeah. That's what I think I had lots of time to think about it.
You guys are ready.
You sound so calm. And that seems unbelievable given what was ahead of you. What happened next?
Well, we did pursue the surgery, and it was terrifying and painful and overwhelming. And exactly like Dr. Adzik said, we just had to take it a day at a time. We got the surgery, and both my daughter and I did great during the surgery, and they were happy with how that procedure went. And then we made it to 36 weeks and 6 days, and Luelle was born. And it was incredible to meet our daughter, who we had, pursued so much for her before we had even seen her. So that was really special.
And Dr. Adzik, when did this field start?
Well, fetal surgery started to, the outrageous concept was to correct life-threatening birth defects before birth. That was about 30 years ago. And all of the experimental work derived from that frustration in taking care of newborn babies who had lethal birth defects where we were too late to do anything. And the concept was to do something before birth, which at that time the skeptics thought there were at least 100 reasons why you couldn't possibly do that. With adult medical care, you're too late if a patient already has cancer metastases or if a patient has already had a heart attack, if you had just gotten to them earlier. But with certain types of birth defects where there's progressive organ damage before birth, the only solution is to do something before birth, which is what fetal surgery is.
What are some of the
big challenges in doing these surgeries?
Well, for open fetal surgery, it's a huge operation. It's an operation not only on the fetus, who may have everything to gain, but also an operation on the mother, like Shelley here, who is medically an innocent bystander. So she has to undergo substantial risk to help her unborn child.
And how does that weigh on you as a surgeon? It's a double responsibility.
Well, there's in my life, there's a lot of uncertainty, that's for sure. And so you have to share medically that uncertainty with patients. So that comes later when you counsel about the steps of the operations, about the various sort of sandbars and river dams and all sorts of things that the Ross ship could encounter during this post-surgery and intra-surgery adventure. And then long-term, there's uncertainty. There's not a tremendous amount of immediate gratification. You have to do it one step at a time. It's a little bit like driving a car at night on a winding road, and it's pitch black except for your headlights, and you can just see sort of the road a little bit ahead of you. And you have to rely on the fact that there's a road, that your lights work, and that you'll eventually get to your destination.
Shelley and Bobby, your daughter is 1 year old now. How is she doing?
She's doing great. We're so thankful and don't take for granted that she's doing so well, because we know that's not a guarantee. But she's crawling and pulling up to a stand and hasn't needed any major interventions yet, hopefully not at all. And she's just got a sweet little personality. She's smiling and laughing and loves playing with her brother. So she's doing really well.
Thank you all so much for being here and for talking with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Scott Adzik is Surgeon-in-Chief at the Center for Fetal Diagnosis and Treatment at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. We were also joined by Bobby and Shelley Ross, who say the center saved their daughter from a life with serious, serious disability. Coming up on The Pulse, let's say you're getting a gift card for somebody. Chances are you'll make it $20 or $50 or $100, not $37, definitely not $23. Why do we love round numbers? It's more complicated than it might seem. Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and believes everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region, as well as a range of health plans designed to fit your budget. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca invests more than $4 billion each year in the discovery and development of innovative medicines, collaborating with noted scientists and academic institutions. AstraZeneca's combination of capabilities in small molecules, biologics, immunotherapies, and protein engineering is reinforced by a strong focus on translational science and personalized healthcare. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. If you're trying to lose a bunch of weight, I predict you'll get excited when you've lost 10 pounds. 9 pounds is pretty cool, but 10 pounds, that's a milestone. We celebrate round birthdays, anniversaries, and so on. Why? Just because they end in a zero? Regular Pulse contributor Christopher Intagliata takes us on a mathematical journey with some unexpected twists and turns.
Round numbers have an irresistible allure to market watchers. Remember back in December when the Dow Jones Industrial Average hit a new high? A nice round number.
Dow at 18,000.
Above 18,000 at the start.
18,000.
18,000 and counting.
18,000 just hit. Check it out.
I like it. 18,000. I know it's just a number. So
yeah,
don't
write it's just a number. So why do we celebrate the number with three zeros at the end instead of 17,999? One way to answer that question would be to bring in a numbers guy.
I think a lot of people don't know that number theory is still going on. They think the problems were all solved a long time ago by dudes in robes.
This is Jordan Ellenberg, not a dude in a robe. He's a number theorist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And when the Dow hits some new milestone, his reaction is pretty much, who cares?
in many ways, it's completely arbitrary, right? I mean, we could measure the Dow on a different scale, and that number that's 18,000 might instead be 16,463, and it would mean the exact same thing.
That part about measuring the Dow on a different scale, we'll get to that a bit later. But I want to get this other issue out of the way first. More than being a numbers question, what a lot of this really boils down to is human psychology, how we're built.
Quantifying is one of the fundamental human activities. We've done it in every civilization that we've ever had. It's kind of like music or something, right? It's not even clear we would really be human without doing it. It's just one of the fundamental ways we apprehend our world.
And we're not talking just any old numbers. We like round numbers. All those zeros, they're like a breath of fresh air.
We like things that are simple, that are easy to process, that are easy to make sense of, that are easy to understand.
Adam Alter is a professor of marketing and psychology at New York University. And one of the things he's studied is the meaningfulness of round numbers.
They're great guideposts if you're looking at goals, for example, if you're aiming for something, to lose a certain amount of weight, to run a marathon at a certain pace. Those round numbers serve as very salient goals. They're very powerful, they're very visible, and they're easy to recall and remember. And so I think they are useful for all those reasons.
This stuff obviously goes way beyond the stock market. Round numbers rule our lives in a whole lot of ways. SAT takers, for example, are more likely to retake the test if they fall just short of a round number. And don't forget the all-important batting average in baseball. Major League players are four times as likely to end the season with a 300 batting average,
that's a big 300 batting average,
than a 299. That's not a coincidence. It's because batters just under 300 almost never walk on their last at-bat. They go for the base hit. And batters who've already achieved 300, much more likely to send in a pinch hitter.
Pinch hitter extraordinaire, John Vanderwalla.
Remember, 300, it's just a number, but it actually changes the player's behavior. And in case you're wondering, even number theorists like Ellenberg aren't immune to the charms of a round number.
I can't deny that I have in my mind the idea of the 300 hitter. I may know that that number is a meaningless and arbitrary benchmark, but I can't deny it has a certain force with me. And if I live to be 100, I'm sure I'm going to get myself like a really, really big cake, even though I know it's arbitrary.
But hey, you probably don't need fancy research to tell you round numbers are important. You use them all the time in your own life, right? Estimating expenses, negotiating your salary, and talking about your age.
We talk about being in our 30s and our 40s and our 50s. We don't talk about being in our 30-70s.
This is mathematician Eugenia Chang, scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And I promised earlier that I'd get to how arbitrary our number system is, why our world's dominated by tens rather than multiples of seven or some other number. And here it is.
It's very intimately linked to the fact that we have 10 fingers.
10 fingers and 10 toes.
Probably because we have 10 fingers, so...
Yeah, heard that answer a lot. That the reason we ended up with the base 10 system, the decimal system, is basically an evolutionary accident. After all, we do learn to count on our fingers, our digits. And I'll get back to counting on fingers a little later. But the point is, counting in ones, tens, hundreds, thousands comes so natural to us now that it's easy to forget there are alternatives.
There's a popular mathematical game that you play where you imagine that you're on an alien planet where the aliens only have, say, 7 fingers.
And then, of course, you end up with a base 7 system. But no need to even make up aliens to imagine different number systems. Just go back 5,000 years to the Sumerians. They developed a sexagesimal system, base 60, which they later passed on to the Babylonians. 60 minutes, 60 seconds, 360 degrees, that all comes from the Babylonians. Their numbers still hang out in the shadows of our modern number system. And I said I'd come back to counting on fingers, because I wanted to mention that ending up with base 10, because we have 10 fingers, isn't really the only way things could have turned out. Some cultures in the Middle East and Asia actually count to 12 on each hand. If you look at your palm, this will be easier to explain. Using the thumb as a pointer, just count each of the 3 little bones on each of your fingers. Pinky, ring, middle, index, and bingo, 12. Base 12 may even predate the Sumerians. And like base 60, there's still bits of base 12 fossilized in our modern world. A dozen, 12 inches, 12 hours. And here's the thing. Even though we ended up with 10, to mathematicians, 12 is much more attractive.
In base 12, you can divide numbers by 2, 3, 4, and 6.
quite easily, because 12 divides by 2, 3, 4, and 6.
Mathematician Ian Stewart of the University of Warwick in the UK. He says, from a practical standpoint, 10 is actually kind of lousy.
We still sell eggs by the dozen. And if you've got 12 eggs, you can divide them equally between 2 people, 3 people, 4 people, or 6 people. You can't do it with 5. 10's not as good. If you've got 10 eggs, you can divide them between 2 people or 5, but not 3, not 4.
12 works so much better, and its clean divisions are so beautiful, so tempting, that some people actually think our society would be better off if we converted to base 12, the duodecimal or dozenal system. These people call themselves dozenalists, and they have their own conferences and organizations, like the Dozenal Society of America. Don Goodman is the president and an attorney by day. Does he think we're switching over anytime soon?
I think it's pretty unlikely, I'll say that. But I think what's more important is to get people thinking about these things. Thinking about mathematics in non-decimal bases can really enhance one's understanding of what numbers are and how they work.
So when this moment inevitably rolls around,
how about down 19,000?
Maybe you'll think about it a little differently. After all, in dozenal,
I would say 10, 11, 11, 4.
For The Pulse, I'm Christopher Intagliata.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Autism was first described in 1943 as a very rare condition. Starting in the 1990s, there was a dramatic rise in autism diagnoses. Why remains a million-dollar question, but the increase has sparked frantic research into the causes and treatments of this developmental disorder. Children born with autism today have over two decades of intensive research to draw on. There are best practices for early intervention and education. But for that first wave, that first big peer group of kids with autism who are now young adults, these resources and roadmaps don't quite exist. Katie Heiler reports.
Inside the warehouse of Hopewell Valley Vineyards in Pennington, New Jersey, Tyler Bell stands hunched over a box, expertly working a glue gun as he seals the flaps shut. Tyler is 22. He likes working out at the gym, Harley-Davidson motorcycles, and hanging out with his friend Kevin.
Can I tell you about my friend Kevin? Kevin is my new friend. He lives in Robbinsville. We go bowling together on Mondays. He is a cool guy.
Tyler has autism. He doesn't speak more than a word or two unless he's reading off one of the chat cards he carries around to practice having conversations. He moves with a shuffling walk and is prone to staying still for long periods of time. And yet Tyler is able to work 5 hours a week gluing boxes shut for the winery. He gets paid 25 cents a box, but it is a very slow process. Tyler and another autistic 20-something, David, first worked together to learn the task. One folded the box and held the flaps, the other operated the glue gun.
Good job, Tyler.
Most employers wouldn't have the patience for this, and that's becoming an important issue for the autism community. As children with autism grow into young adults with autism, they are having to deal with all the same challenges their developmentally normal peers face, including finding a job, making friends, and living independently. And while it's rocky terrain for any young person to navigate, for young adults with autism, there are few places to turn for help.
The bottom line is we don't have a well-developed evidence base about what works for whom once people enter adulthood.
Dr. Paul Shattuck is director of the Life Course Outcomes Research Program at the A.J. Drexel Autism Institute in Philadelphia. The majority of the autism research being done right now is focused on autism in children, which, Shattuck explains, has to do with advances in the fields of neuroscience and genetics that happened in the 1990s.
Parents of young children with autism were looking at their young child's diagnosis and saying, hey, we want the benefit of this science also. You know, our kids are sick. They have a neurological problem, and there's some kind of biological basis. There was kind of a Me Too energy.
The result was 20 years of research into the origin and development of autism in children. But now this generation of kids with autism is all grown up. And Shattuck is one of the few researchers asking, what happens now?
We're focusing more attention on things like, do people have a job? Do people have friends? Are they living in a supportive community? What kinds of supports and services do they have access to?
Shattuck already has answers to some of these questions. His research indicates that in the years after high school, 50% of young people on the autism spectrum have no job, no vocational training, no college preparation. That's twice the rate of young adults with an intellectual disability or a severe mental illness. It's why some parents of autistic young adults call the years after high school falling off a cliff.
He's busy right now. I know. See, how many points do you have?
Fortunately, Tyler's mom, Liz, saw that cliff coming and was able to do something about it.
We pulled him out his junior year in high school to try and start getting him immersed in what life is like in the real world, mm-hmm. as opposed to learning high school. We wanted him to learn life.
Tyler's parents spent the next 4 years teaching Tyler things like how to order food at a restaurant or use the ATM the best way they knew how, with lots of repetition and practice. Today, researchers know exactly what types of therapies can help a child with autism in the classroom. But Shattuck says these kinds of best practice approaches won't work for young adults trying to answer these big questions about early adulthood.
It makes sense with very young children to think about approaches to intervention where you're trying to create sort of a standardized approach. I don't have much belief in the idea that we're going to find these sort of perfectible approaches to teach things like getting a job.
Instead, Shattuck says the future will look different for each young adult on the autism spectrum, and so will the way to get there. Since pulling him out of school, Liz has been in charge of Tyler's day-to-day activities. She is his chauffeur and his gym buddy. She hangs around the winery while Tyler works just to keep an eye on him. She has accepted that her son will need constant supervision, even as an adult.
You know, the freedoms that come with your kids reaching a certain age don't happen for us.
Since turning 21, Tyler gets funding from the New Jersey Department of Developmental Disabilities and Medicaid. The state provides families with a budget of anywhere between $16,000 and $30,000 a year to pay for the services these young adults need.
Quite honestly, if he could pay taxes instead of being the beneficiary of tax dollars, you know, that would be the ideal situation.
That's Tyler's dad, Peter Bell.
We're trying to figure out what is his niche in life. What is he good at? What does he like to do? What is going to be meaningful?
But for many families, that's easier said than done. Shepherding their autistic child into adulthood can be overwhelming for parents. While their child is in school, parents work with a built-in support team of teachers and specialists who track and monitor their child's progress. But when a student becomes an adult, it's the parents who take over managing their child's autism. This can be a big change for some parents, especially those who were told to stay out of the way while their child was in school.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
As Tyler's mom and full-time chaperone, Liz knows what this parental helplessness feels like. But being in charge of Tyler's care has also helped Liz see that he is capable of doing things other adults do.
He pushes me out of the way when I start to unpack the dishwasher because he knows how to do it and he wants to do it. And so I think when the world is difficult for you, that when you are taught something to a level that you feel some sense of success and pride, that it becomes something that you want to do.
And as for figuring out what type of work Tyler might like to do, his parents take a cue from his smile.
How do you feel about that box?
Good.
Good. Are you proud?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For The Pulse, I'm Katie Heidler.
Coming up on The Pulse, in America's early days, science became a patriotic way to fight back against the dubious claims of a French researcher.
He believed that when species moved to America, where the climate was colder and wetter, that they actually degenerated and became smaller and weaker, which, of course, was a real affront to Jefferson, who wanted to prove just the opposite.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and believes everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region, as well as a range of health plans designed to fit your budget. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca is focused on transforming cutting-edge science into meaningful medicines. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca U.S. Community Connections.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Have you ever found yourself staring at the tile floor in your kitchen and suddenly you see something? Or you feel like you're hearing real words and random sound? Like right now, did you hear that? What did they say? Alana Gordon brings us this audio exploration of a weird brain phenomenon.
Pareidolia.
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 What does it mean?
Something that is meaningless being perceived as significant.
I went to get my second half of my sandwich, and it was open. And I looked down, and I saw Jesus in my cucumber.
I suppose they're calling it a miracle on toast.
A Hopkins couple says they were just eating chili when the miracle happened. An image that, if you look closely, could be interpreted to resemble Jesus.
Our faces pick out a pattern out of random stimuli, and we think it's significant.
I one time saw the person cloud in the sunset.
Completely meaningless.
The cloud looks like a faraway castle built out of stone. Also might look like a fish or a lamb.
Jayatri Das, chief bioscientist at the Franklin Institute. Why do our brains do this?
So pareidolia is based on the fact that your brain tends to see things that you expect to see. If you think about it, no one ever talks about seeing really bizarre objects. It's always faces or familiar things. And this is because your brain has shortcuts for recognizing these things, especially faces. You actually have a particular region of your brain called the fusiform face area that's specifically dedicated to recognizing faces. And scientists have shown that this part of the brain is activated during episodes of pareidolia when people see faces. So why? And if you think about it, there's a real evolutionary advantage to be able to recognize a face at the drop of a hat.
How so?
So imagine that, you know, long time ago in the land of our evolutionary ancestors, there's somebody coming around the corner and you don't know whether they're friend or foe. If you can recognize their face and discern whether this is somebody who's an ally or an enemy right away, then you're more likely to survive. And this is something that still carries an advantage. Being able to recognize people's faces and read their emotions is good for us.
So is it that sometimes when I'm looking at a piece of toast or at a cucumber, my brain snaps into recognize face mode?
Exactly. So when we're looking at somebody's face, we don't individually necessarily analyze, okay, here's an eye, here's another eye, here's a nose, here's a mouth. We look at the picture as a whole and recognize a spacing of these different features. And when that same spacing appears in an otherwise meaningless image, we see a face.
How about seeing shapes in the clouds?
It's really based on our imagination. We heard the little girl talking about castles and fish, and it's likely that those are things that she's looking at in other parts of her life. And we find things that are relevant to us.
There's also an audio version. Early we heard some music and I kept thinking, like, I think I just heard something. I heard somebody say something. Is that a similar thing?
It's the same idea. Again, your brain has shortcuts for interpreting information based on what you've already experienced. The face issue is something that's visual, but this also happens with audio information.
So we want to pick out a pattern, something that we can recognize and make sense of.
Exactly. And your brain is always doing this. because it's much easier for the brain to assign these patterns and categorize new information into things that it already knows.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Jayatri Das is the chief bioscientist at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. And a quick shout out to regular Pulse contributor Bethany Brookshire, also known as PsyCurious, for her help with this piece as well. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. At the dawn of America, science was not just a passionate pursuit of knowledge. It became a bit of a patriotic hammer. Along with Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson was a chief promoter of American science. A new exhibit at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia details his dedication to finding examples of power and strength in nature to make a case for the might of his young nation. Peter Crimmins reports.
In 1781, just as colonial soldiers won the Battle of Yorktown, which would cinch their independence from the British, Thomas Jefferson took time away from the Revolutionary War to write notes on the state of Virginia. It's a catalog of the flora and fauna of his home state. He was the governor. In it, he made the case that the New World not only merited its own government, but its own scientists, too. It was the only book he would publish in his lifetime. The book was a reaction to a questionnaire drawn up by the French delegate in Philadelphia, François Marbois. At the time, the French and most of Europe did not believe America had any decent scientists, and that the study of the New World's new discoveries would be better left to the French. Curator Tara McGowan says Jefferson, like any good politician, rewrote those questions so he could give the answers he wanted.
The French had said that America had no geniuses. So he says, of course, we have a Washington, we have Benjamin Franklin, we have Rittenhouse. He's definitely moving beyond Virginia.
McGowan put an original copy of Notes on the State of Virginia in the new exhibition at the American Philosophical Society called Jefferson, Science and Exploration. The Philosophical Society is a throwback to when what we now call science was called natural philosophy. It was founded in 1743 by Benjamin Franklin to promote, quote, useful knowledge. Members were more involved with cataloging species and engineering a better fireplace than pondering the existence of the soul or the nature of self. In 1797, Jefferson was named president of the society, and he made sure that knowledge was not only useful, but politically effective. He had a bone to pick with the French scientist, the Count de Buffon, who believed that species could become extinct. It was a radical idea at the time.
You realize this is a pre-Darwin world, so most people did not believe in extinction. He believed that when species moved to America, where the climate was colder and wetter, that they actually degenerated and became smaller and weaker, which, of course, was a real affront to Jefferson, who wanted to prove just the opposite.
He was right, of course. And to show how strong America is, Jefferson sent a Montana moose to Buffon in Paris. But in terms of extinction, Jefferson was on the wrong side of science. Ultimately, it was Buffon who was closer to the truth with his concept of the degeneration of species.
Buffon's ideas did lead to the idea of extinction because things could degenerate to the point where they, you know, would die out. He was really going against the current and against the church at the time.
The problem with the idea of extinction was religion. God makes everything perfect, so it does not stand to reason that he could make anything that would go extinct. In fact, they wrote a song about it. In 1800, famed scientist and artist Charles Wilson Peale gave a series of lectures about natural history at the University of Pennsylvania, and he was accompanied by a song written by his son, Rembrandt Peale. It was called The Beauties of Creation.
Mark the beauties of creation.
The sheet music for that song is in the exhibition at the Philosophical Society. Here it was performed by the Pulse Singers. All of which brings us to the American mastodon. It's a large animal distantly related to the elephant, which Jefferson believed was a mammoth. Bones of a mastodon had been discovered in Kentucky, but Jefferson needed a living one to dispute the idea of extinction.
There was a sense that the further they pushed west, they might actually be able to find a mammoth still living.
This is the exhibition's other curator, Lynette Regaby.
That's part of what they're looking for with Lewis and Clark.
Jefferson was hungry for reports from the explorers, Lewis and Clark, about sightings of a mastodon or a mammoth. It didn't matter, as long as it was alive and bigger than anything they had in Europe.
The mammoth was wonderful for Jefferson's goals of proving that American nature was just as large and gargantuan and powerful as European nature.
And it was really important for them to think that this was a fierce creature, so they really pushed the idea of it being a carnivore until they could no longer.
Not only has the mastodon been extinct for 10,000 years, it was also an herbivore. It was never a predatory creature, but a peaceful vegetarian. Undaunted, Jefferson turned his attention to another ferocious creature discovered in the Americas. McGowan has a fossil of what appears to be an enormous claw.
This giant claw was found actually in Virginia and sent to Jefferson, and he was very excited because he thought it was probably from an American lion.
Upon further study, scientists found that that claw was not designed to retract like a cat, so it could not come from a lion. It
turned out to be a giant ground sloth.
Quite a letdown from a tiger to a sloth.
Big letdown, especially as you know, sloth had not a very good meaning at the time, being one of the deadly sins. So that was a big disappointment for him. But it shows how much fierceness, strength, and size was important in this debate between the New World and the Old.
Jefferson remained president of the Philosophical Society for 18 years while he was president of the United States, and he made it the main clearinghouse of scientific discovery in America. So all over the new nation, if you dug up something weird, you sent it to 5th and Chestnut Streets in Philadelphia to get your answers. For The Pulse, I'm Peter Crimmins.
And finally, this week marks a massive comeback for the only dinosaur to go extinct twice, if you will. We're talking about a gigantic creature dino fans have been calling...
Brontosaurus. He has a really long neck and a long tail.
The Brontosaurus was named in 1879 by famed paleontologist Othniel Marsh, who found the specimen. Drexel University paleontologist Ken Lacovera said this dinosaur quickly became an audience favorite.
Brontosaurus was one of the first dinosaurs to really enter the public imagination. It became very popular in museums and in children's books.
But this golden era lasted just a bit over 20 years. In 1903, paleontologist Elmer Riggs proclaimed that Brontosaurus was apparently the same as the Apatosaurus, which had been found first. So it was game over for the Brontosaurus. Here's Ken Lacovera again.
And so the species Brontosaurus excelsus was essentially assassinated, thrown on the scientific trash heap, and Brontosaurus had to change its name to Apatosaurus.
Now, most people still use the term Brontosaurus to describe this beast, but it just wasn't scientifically correct until this week, when the Brontosaurus made a full comeback thanks to paleontologist Emmanuel Chop, who is at the New University of Lisbon in Portugal. I actually tracked him down in Switzerland, and I said to him, hey, you'll be the guy who brought back the Brontosaurus.
Yeah, it seems.
Oh, scientists, always so modest. His team analyzed almost 500 different physical features of 81 specimens, some of them relatively newly discovered, and they found that there are significant differences. For example,
Apatosaurus has a very wide neck, and Brontosaurus, on the other hand, has rather a high neck. So they differ in neck shape.
News of Chop's research has thrilled dino fans and researchers alike, among them Jason Poole, who is coordinator for Dinosaur Hall and the Fossil Preparation Lab at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia.
Surprises like what's happened with Brontosaurus are kind of rare, sort of like getting to enjoy part of your childhood again. So it's been fun. Brontosaurus is just iconic. It's got such a cool name. It means, thunder lizard, which is wicked cool.
Wicked cool. Poole says this back and forth also makes for a great teaching moment.
It enables us to talk a little bit more about the nature of how science works and how definitely how paleontology works.
Poole is also a dino illustrator, and he told me his next painting will definitely be a Brontosaurus. By the way, Ken Lecavera thinks another scientific audience favorite will make a comeback this year after having been demoted in status. Want to know what it is? Sign up for our newsletter at whyy.org/pulse-newsletter. And now we're going to finish today's show with the comeback song for the Brontosaurus. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Avery Brookins is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our managing editor. Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Chris Cetullo is vice president of news. And Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes and at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback, your ideas, your questions at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a generous leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands gladly support WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.